Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 14th of June. For a long time now, we've been asking the question, how do we get the unemployment rate down? How do we create jobs? And our guest this hour has a very unique and interesting idea. And I think that you will want to respond to what he has to say. Professor Randall Ray is a professor of economics and research director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. He wrote an article recently in The Nation titled 0% Unemployment Possible. The private sector role, he says, is invaluable and dynamic in creating jobs, but it cannot ensure enough jobs to keep up with population growth or speed economic recovery, much less achieve the social goal of full employment for all Americans. The alternative is a job guarantee through a government-provided employer of last resort program. This would offer a job to anybody who's ready and willing to work at the federal minimum wage plus legislative benefits. He says that the results of full employment would mean production of goods, services, and income, on-the-job training, skill development, poverty alleviation, community building, and social networking. We talk about his idea and also look at the president's trip to North Carolina and other plans that are in place or being called for to create jobs in this country. We welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you're welcome to do that. That's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Professor Ray. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So instead of an unemployment insurance program, benefits program, it would be completely the opposite, an employment program.
Yeah, it seems to me to make much more sense to actually employ people doing useful things rather than paying them not to work.
Is this an idea that has ever been tried in the United States?
Oh, sure. In the Great Depression, of course, the New Deal had a variety of programs, we could say an alphabet soup of the CCC and so on, that created jobs and that in which the workers did useful things. And we can still see the products of their work all over the United States, lots of public buildings. There was public infrastructure built, including Boulder or Hoover Dam. So those things are still with us.
Mm-hmm.
About 13 million people worked in New Deal jobs programs. If you scaled that up for population growth, you know, we would be somewhere around 25 million, which is just about exactly the number of jobs that we need right now to employ the people who cannot find jobs in the private sector and government sector, which, of course, is downsizing.
And those kinds of jobs would be what, essentially rebuilding the infrastructure in this country, or does it go beyond that?
Well, I would go beyond that. It's pretty clear that we need a lot of infrastructure investment. Really, since the 1960s, the government has not been providing the infrastructure that we really need. Engineers every year estimate the public infrastructure investment deficit, that is, not taking care of the infrastructure that we have and not building new infrastructure. And it's $3 trillion worth. So there is room for that. But, you know, these things take a lot of time, and not everyone can work in construction on public infrastructure projects. So we need a variety of other kinds of jobs. And another area where we're seriously deficient is in public services.
Public services such as?
Well, we need care for the aged.
Yes.
And as I said in that Nation article, of course the private sector can provide lots of jobs, but there is a lot of work out there that is not profitable, at least currently, for the private sector to undertake. And it's just not reasonable to expect the private sector to employ people doing things that don't earn profits for Now, in the United States, we're lucky because we have a lot of NGOs, non-governmental, not-for-profit organizations that provide a lot of care for the elderly, care for the young, care for people with disabilities and so on. And they're being hurt seriously by this global financial collapse. Their donations have come down. State and local governments are less able to afford to help support them. And they would be happy to employ more people if we provided them with the wages that they need.
And it would seem to me, as the population, as the demographics change all over the world, that the kinds of jobs that you're talking about are really crucial, and there will be a great need for even more of those jobs.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, we are a service sector economy. The majority of workers in America work in the service sector, and the kinds of jobs that we need done are largely in the service sector. So that's why I want to get beyond this view that what we need is the only thing we need is public infrastructure investment. We do need it, but most of the jobs we create in the government sector and in the private sector are going to be in services. What we need is human services, providing help for, as you point out, we have a major demographic transition going on to an aged society, and we're going to need more help for elderly people, and this is a very good way to create jobs.
Considering the fact that we keep comparing what we're going through right now as the worst economic time since the Great Depression, why is it, or maybe there was a great deal of debate about this back in FDR's administration, why is it that a government-provided employer of last resort program is really not on the table right now, and yet it was, and it was very successful during his administration?
Yeah. That's a very difficult question. The unemployment rate in the Great Depression was higher than it is now. And that is in part due to the existence of a variety of other government programs that we have, including unemployment compensation that keeps some income flowing to people who lose their jobs, and a variety of welfare-type programs that help to reduce the unemployment rate compared to the Great Depression. So instead of a 25% official unemployment rate, we have an official unemployment rate of 9.1% now. So by some measures, the Great Depression was very much worse than this very severe downturn. So I think that's part of the reason that we haven't seen calls for it. I think that we still have too much trust in the private sector to pull us out of this, and I think gradually over time, as we do not recover, the faith that the private sector alone is going to get us out of this great crash is going to wither away, and eventually we're going to realize the federal government is going to have to play a bigger role. We will not get out of this downturn without a bigger role for the federal government. Now, of course, what I'm saying goes completely against the debates going on in Washington.
It sure does.
Which I think are not economic debates. What we're hearing out of Washington, and this is, I'm not blaming one party or the other, it's both parties, is pure economic nonsense. The idea that by cutting government spending, we're going to somehow stimulate the economy because private initiative is going to be unleashed is just ridiculous. No serious economist believes this story. It's politics. It's not economics. The private sector is not going to start creating jobs at a sufficient pace to lower the unemployment rate. until we get a recovery. The private sector can't do this because it's in the business of making profits. And as private sector firms look around, they don't see profits out there. What they see is it's a very difficult time to try to produce goods and sell them at a profit.
What about this whole field of green energy, which the president has touted for a number of years, and many people think that it simply has to happen for the well-being of the planet? The president has been pressing for more jobs in targeted industry, including green energy jobs. The Startup America program is one of the probably highest profile efforts that the government has launched to help small businesses, and some of that money is going for green energy. Can't the private sector really jumpstart that whole industry, and couldn't it be big?
I think we do need to move toward green jobs. I think the private sector has a role to play, and government subsidies to the private sector are probably necessary, at least in the beginning, to jumpstart that sector. But I have two buts here. The first is that believing that this is going to create 25 million jobs, which is what we need, is just complete fancy. That is not going to happen. This is not going to be a huge sector. We could probably create more jobs in environmental cleanup, New Deal type jobs funded by the federal government to help clean up the environment. That will create more jobs than green energy is likely to create. The second problem is that using subsidies to try to reduce hiring costs sufficiently for the private sector to create jobs is a very expensive and iffy way to create jobs. You have to provide huge subsidies, which the evidence of subsidies for job creation is not very good, because there's a lot of substitution. What firms will do is take the government subsidy and hire workers using that subsidy and lay off workers that don't qualify for the subsidy. So the net job creation from subsidy programs in the past has never been very big. So I'm skeptical for both of these reasons that subsidies to private employers are going to solve our unemployment problem.
We go to phone calls. Our lines are filled on this topic. Professor Randall Ray is our guest this hour. Wrote an interesting piece in The Nation in which he said that what we need to create jobs in this country is a government-provided employer of last resort program, offering a job to anyone who's ready and willing to work at the federal minimum wage plus legislated benefits. He also goes into a philosophical discussion of full employment, which he says has been wrongly dismissed as impossible and economically counterproductive. We'll talk more about that as we continue our conversation. Here's how you join us, 800-486-8655. Just wait for a line to be free. Email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program will be looking at the Civil War. Our guests will include Doris Kearns Goodwin, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, author of many books, most pertinent to our discussion. Our number two, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. She's going to be in Milwaukee giving a speech on that topic for the Wisconsin Historical Society this Thursday. Michael Edmonds will also join us, who's in charge of the digital collections and web services in the Library of the Archives Division of the Wisconsin Historical Society. They are adding every week all kinds of documents that examine Wisconsin's role in the Civil War, diaries and newspaper articles and maps and discussion of battles. So that's our conversation, hour two of the program. Two phone calls now on how do we get the unemployment rate down. Rick in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your economist guest. I don't want him to think that I'm being argumentative. I just want to put a little more flesh on the bones of this problem. So I've got three categories here that I'm going to zip through fast. First, we have a short-term lack of aggregate demand. This could be addressed either by the Congress appropriating more money for stimulus or by the Fed engaging in open market operations, in other words, buying back federal government debt to pump more money into the economy. That would only be short-term. Number two, we got a long-term debt problem. The biggest way to put confidence back into the bond market is by fixing Social Security. Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, who were political enemies, were able to do this job and fix it. It only takes a little change in the benefit package for people who are below the age of retirement. It wouldn't affect anybody who's already retired. Then number three is unemployment. We've got people who've been unemployed for a year or more, 2 years or more. They're getting stale. They're losing their skills. We need really a big training program for our workers. We need to work on the quality of our educational system, particularly in community colleges and technical colleges. We need job-targeted education, training programs with constant monitoring to make sure that they're actually getting people trained for jobs that they can take. And last of all, we need some really massive cuts in some of these federal programs at the same time that we're engaging in stimulus. We got almost 950 federal welfare programs in the federal government. Congress and the president could cut this down to maybe a dozen programs, and the money saved by doing this could be used to add to the general stimulus package.
All right, Professor Ray.
Okay, first, short-term lack of aggregate demand. Yes, absolutely. We lost over 8 million jobs, and that is because of a decline of aggregate demand. In addition to the jobs program, I do support some demand stimulus. And just real quickly, let me mention two ways to do that. One is a payroll tax holiday. We got a bit of one already. I would increase the payroll tax holiday to eliminate tax collection on both the employees and employers. That adds about $12 billion per week back into the pockets of workers and their employers. It actually reduces the cost of hiring workers, and I would have the payroll tax holiday run until we reach some targeted unemployment rate, let's say 3 or 4% unemployment rate. So that adds aggregate demand. Another is we know that state and local governments are in a fiscal crisis. We could add about $400 billion through federal government block grants, the old President Nixon idea, to let state and local governments have more revenue so that they don't have to continue to downsize. So, yes, I agree on that. The long-term debt problem, okay, this would be a whole show by itself. This is another purely political debate going on in Washington, well-funded by Pete Peterson, a hedge fund multi-billionaire who's decided to devote his wealth to whipping up deficit hysteria. Again, this is economic nonsense. The federal government cannot go broke. The long-term debt problems are created not by Social Security, but by Medicare. It is because we have an unsustainable health care delivery system, not just the Medicare portion, but the private portion too. The projected budget deficits and growing debt through eternity will not happen, because eventually we are going to reform healthcare in the United States. We will move toward the kind of healthcare system that every other rich, developed, capitalist country in the world has, which is single payer. But that's a whole other issue.
And it may be 100 years before we get there.
No.
You don't think so?
We'll get there within 10 years because
everyone is
focused on the federal government going bankrupt. But I'll tell you who really is going to go bankrupt. It's going to be workers and their employers. They will go bankrupt long before the federal government debt explodes. And the reason is because we can't. afford the system we've got. It's the private insurers that are the problem. It's really not Medicare, and it's not that our health care costs are too high. It's our health insurance costs are too high. Okay, the third issue was that we have millions of people who are unemployed and losing their skills, who've been unemployed long-term, and this is exactly right. Almost half of the unemployed have been unemployed for more than half of a year, and when people are unemployed, they start developing bad habits in addition to losing their skills. This is why I think it's better to employ people than to pay them not to work. As soon as they lose their job in the private sector or in state and local government, we need to get them employed so that they retain good habits and they retain their skills and they can even learn more skills on the job. That's why I like a job guarantee more than I like either welfare or unemployment compensation. Now, I think there is a problem in believing that training and education is a solution to unemployment. And Obama, unfortunately, is focusing mostly on providing training. Look, it does no good to train people for jobs that don't exist. We have at least four people right now who are unemployed for every job vacancy. It doesn't do any good to train more people, to have more people searching for a limited number of jobs. It's like, if I've got 10 dogs and I bury 9 bones out in the backyard, I know at least one dog's going to come back without a bone. I can give him training. I can train him in the latest bone-finding techniques. That dog might come back with a bone next time, but you know another dog is not going to get a bone. The solution is give 10 bones. Let's give 10 jobs for every 10 people seeking jobs. Then let's worry about the training. Give them a job first. Train them on the job. It's the best way to train people. And meanwhile, they're employed and doing useful things.
What did you think of the president's proposal announced yesterday in Durham that he wanted to train 10,000 American engineering students a year in a program that would be focused on filling high-tech jobs?
Well, you know, look, I'm an educator. I teach in a university. I think education is great. I'd like to see more Americans getting degrees in the sciences and in economics. It's true that in some of the more technical areas, it is hard to get Americans. We're filling the space in the classrooms with foreigners. Now, there are two solutions. Let's say that we really are short trained engineers. One is train more Americans for the jobs, and the other is make it easier for immigrants to get jobs to fill those vacancies. I actually am supportive of both of those tacks. But look, 10,000 trained engineers per year is not going to solve our unemployment problem when we've got 14 million officially unemployed people right now, where the private sector is only creating 50,000 jobs per month. So the Obama plan is a drop in the bucket. It's not going to solve our unemployment problem.
Thanks, Rick, for your call. Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee next. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to talk about the snooty people of the world, like Tyler Matheson and his daughter, Brooke, from CNBC, and link this up with jobs and the debt and flash mobs and whether we're going to have concentration camps for the poor to keep things under control in the country. And I say that tongue-in-cheek. And, you know, the whole premise of the Bible is, you know, we're supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves. But when it comes down to the elite ruling class, the Mathesons of the world, caring about the poor, they have no empathy. They're basically heartless. They're glad that productivity is increased because it's helped business, but they don't care about the people that are left behind, and they obstruct and they sabotage on programs to help the poor. And the outcome of all of this, of course, is when people are laid off, there's no revenue coming in, and these people consume resources like unemployment compensation and welfare and emergency room visits and things of this nature, which just exacerbates the debt problem. And then add to the mix on all of this, we have these situations of the flash mobs where in Chicago people are going into, the poor people are going into richer neighborhoods and robbing people, and this happens at UWM and other places in the Milwaukee area as well. And so what do we propose to do with the poor in this country? Are we going to build a fence around their neighborhoods and put them in concentration camps so they can't leak out and hurt or rob people when they have nothing to do because we deliberately and uncaringly have provided no resources for them? We have to face up to this problem. We just can't leave these people behind. It's not the Christian thing to do.
Professor Ray.
I agree that the social and private costs of unemployment and poverty are huge. And the caller mentioned crime. We incarcerate more than 2 million people, and 600,000 of those get out of prison every year. Their prison experience does not improve their employability for pretty obvious reasons. This is a fairly crazy system. It's much better if we provide people with jobs so they don't get into a life of crime and we don't have to pay to lock them up, so create jobs. Another thing that most people probably don't realize is that being unemployed is extremely unhealthy. So the caller is also right that it increases our health care costs. Incarceration is not good for your health either. That increases health care costs. So, yeah, I agree. It makes much more sense to provide real opportunities for all Americans.
Thanks, Jim. Roland in Janesville. Hi. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, yes. Are you ready for my comment?
We sure are.
Yes. You know, we talk about unemployment, we talk about this and that, and this fellow that's talking on your show, he has got a lot of common sense. But we are paying the price for the draft. We did away with the draft. We're paying the price for educating young people for common jobs. The experience, I'm a Vietnam vet, the experience that we got through going through the military, and we wouldn't went to the military unless we would, was for, but how many Vietnam guys had to go because they got into trouble with the law one way or the other, and then they went in front of the judge, and the judge looked at them, and he said, it looks like you got two choices. You either go in the military, or you're going to go ahead and do your consequence, whatever, as far as whether you pay a fine or you have to go ahead and go to jail for a while, whatever. There was so much experience, and everything through the draft, because nobody wants to go unless they are forced to go. And that young generation you took from in Vietnam, we took 9 million guys out of the workforce, and the government was employing them at that time. And look at the education and the experience we got. Not saying just in the war, but just when I was in boot camp, we fought forest fires up in Ventura, California. We got experience in fighting forest fires. We got experience in so many different things that we look back now as older men, and it's something that you couldn't buy with money, the experience we've gained.
Professor Ray.
You know, if you go back, the military sort of operated as an employer of last resort. That is, if you were a young male and either you weren't able to get into college or it just wasn't something you were interested in doing, and you couldn't find a job otherwise, you could go into the military, you would get training, it would enhance your job prospects when you got out. And so it acted as a huge employer of last resort. So really what I am advocating is modeled on that. Let's have an employer of last resort. It doesn't have to be the military. It could be domestic service, doing the kinds of things we were talking about at the top of the show. And so I agree with the caller. Having young men who, for whatever reason, are not going to go to college and who are unable to get a job, especially when jobs are so scarce as they are today, that creates huge social problems. It probably is going to mean diminished right now that we've got who can't get jobs, for years, decades, maybe the rest of their life, their whole earning stream is going to be much lower. The unemployment rate for teenagers now is 24%.
Oh, my.
So that is like Great Depression numbers. The unemployment rate for blacks of all ages is 16%. These are the official numbers, you know, compared to the overall unemployment rate of 9%. So we are talking about almost Great Depression numbers for teens and for black Americans. And that could have lifelong results. Bad choices, bad luck. The rest of their lives could be permanently altered by this great crash.
Thanks very much for the call, Roland. We do have lines open now. If you've been trying to get through, they've been busy, but lines are available to you for your comments. 800-486-8655 is the number. Email, a couple of those we'll get to momentarily, talk@WPR.org. Scott in La Crosse is next. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen. Wonderful program, as always. Really appreciate this guest. And I would like to preface what I'm going to ask by saying that I've always been a big fan of the WPA and the CCC and the things that they did to make our society better and as well as giving opportunities to a lot of people in real rough shape. But let me run through a quick history here, and please correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that after the crash, the economy went downhill in a terrible slide, really peaking out about 32, 33. FDR comes in. He makes his great speeches. He has these programs. Things start to get better. But then around 37 or so, it falters again, and there's like a second wave of a depression. And then really what pulls us out of the depression for good is the war in Europe, for which we became a major arms and material supplier and put our population to work producing those goods. So my question is, sir, if it wasn't for World War II, if you take World War II out of the equation, do you think FDR's programs would have done the trick? Would have turned the tide?
Okay, that's a very good short history lesson, and I agree with the facts that you stated. We were recovering from the Great Depression, in part due to the New Deal programs. In 1937, we crashed. Actually, we crashed more steeply than we had at the beginning of the Great Depression. So the question is, why did we crash? Well, Roosevelt had actually run on a balanced budget platform, and he reduced government spending and increased taxes in order to try to reduce the budget deficit. Part of the increase in taxes was due to the new Social Security program that had just been enacted. The taxes actually kicked in without the benefit payments. So we raised taxes without actually spending any money on Social Security program. So that also helped to reduce the budget deficit. So my really quick answer would be that Roosevelt lost his nerve, and he went back to fiscal conservatism, and the economy collapsed. And yes, the caller is right. It was the World War II spending that brought us out. Now, could we have gotten out without World War II? We would have needed a bigger New Deal program to deal with the problems. We had 13 million jobs created in all of these programs, WPA, CCC, that we've been mentioning. But the wages were low in the program, and by itself, this probably would not have been enough. Now, we moved from an economy in which total federal government spending in 1929, on the verge of the crash, was only about 3% of GDP, and I don't, you know, want to make this too boring for the listeners, but we had a very, very small government. It really was too small to get us out of the Great Depression. We come out of World War II with a federal government that is 20 to 25% of GDP, depending on what our military spending is, whether we're in war or not. That the government we inherited from World War II is much bigger. It is big enough to deal with a crash if we use government in the right way. So I think that what we came out of World War II with is a permanently bigger federal government presence that helps to offset the swings in the private sector. And I sort of referred to this a little bit earlier. This is why the unemployment rate only, I put that in quotation marks, only goes to 9% rather than 25% like it did in the Great Depression.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Our phone number, 800-486-8655, and our guest wrote an interesting piece that caught our attention in The Nation. Professor Randall Ray is professor of economics and research director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. 0% unemployment possible is the name of the article, and he calls for a government-provided employer of last resort program. Did I give you the email address? talk@wpr.org. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, we're talking about the Civil War. Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin will be joining us, and we will also be speaking with a guest from the Wisconsin Historical Society. They're bringing her in. There's a fundraiser for the Historical Society. Doris is the keynote speaker this coming Thursday night in Milwaukee, and Michael Edmonds will also join us, who's in charge of the digital collections and web services at the Historical Society. They're adding documents each week as the 150th commemoration of the Civil War continues. And so we'll be speaking with both of them, hour number two of the show. Let's go to an email that has come in from Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Aren't recessions based around lack of demand? If products aren't moving off the shelf, a tax cut will not help create demand. President Bush sent out checks to families several times during his presidency. Would something like that help create enough demand to urge employers to hire?
Yeah, you've got to get the tax cuts into the hands of people who are likely to spend them. This is why a lot of people believe that President Bush-type tax cuts that mostly go to high-income people don't add much aggregate demand because they're more likely to save the tax cuts, while tax cuts to, say, average working Americans would tend to stimulate demand more. Now, I think that when Obama's tax cuts came through, people used a lot of that to pay off debt. And so it didn't add a lot to aggregate demand. Now, that doesn't mean it wasn't a good idea, obviously, because people were over-indebted. And reducing their debt loads is good for the long-run health of households and our economy as a whole. So I wouldn't argue against tax cuts just because they go to pay down debt. But the payroll tax holiday that I mentioned would get more take-home pay into the hands of families. They would probably pay down some debt, but they probably would also spend some. I don't think that tax cuts alone are going to do enough of the job. That's why I think we also need to create jobs and actually put wages into the hands of people who need to buy groceries and so on, needs to supplement that. Let me just say one thing, because I might be scaring people when I say that I want a federal government New Deal type employer of last resort job creation program. I don't necessarily mean that the federal government would do all the hiring and would plan all the projects. We need the federal government to pay the wages in the program, but I think it's actually a good idea to decentralize decentralize as much as possible. Let the local not-for-profits do most of the hiring. Let local governments hire to do projects that they've always wanted to do but never had the revenue that they needed to undertake the local projects. So I would let most of the projects be planned and operated at the local community level and just have the federal government pay the wages. So that is a bit different from the way that Roosevelt's New Deal programs were run.
Doug in Green Bay, hi.
Hi. I was just curious. He's proposing, job creation. I'm just curious as to what kind of jobs he thinks we could create that, they're disproportionately going to hit minority youth and young people, that you're going to get, lawsuits that this is forcing jobs on people. I mean, are you talking about forcing people into a job rather than taking payments of welfare or unemployment of some kind? Or is this a voluntary program? Because my father-in-law was in the, I think it's WPA was the abbreviation for it during the Depression.
Yeah.
He sent home $50 a month and worked 8-9 hours a day, 5-6 days a week, essentially lifting rocks and digging trails and building bathhouses and projects like that. He worked on a state fair. I just can't see that working now. I mean, how are you going to get young people, with the young people we have today, to accept these jobs that you speak of? I mean, maybe I'm just confused. I'm trying to figure out what kind of jobs you would be talking about.
Okay. First, what we want to do is to create jobs that take workers as they are. That is, whatever level of education, experience, and training they have, and where they are. That's why I favor job creation by local community organizations and local government, so that people don't have to move out to Arizona, for example, and fight fires. I would create some of those jobs, and people who want to do that, of course, could join up and go do that. But if they want to stay in their community, we need to provide jobs where they are. Now, this would be purely voluntary. This isn't any kind of slavery. Nobody is forced. This is only a job for someone who is willing to work, willing and ready. And I would also say able, but I would define ableness very broadly. We want to include people who have handicaps, living with disabilities. The vast majority of people with disabilities want to work, but they're not able to find jobs in the private sector because private employers don't want to take a chance on them. So I would take workers as they are, with their disabilities, with their training and education that they have, and where they are. Now, there is a question about whether you want to continue to offer unemployment compensation and various kinds of welfare benefits for people who would rather take those than work. I can see arguments for retaining unemployment benefits, say for a limited period, 6 weeks, 12 weeks, something like that, to let people do full-time job search once they've lost their job. You don't necessarily want people who have been laid off to immediately go into this new jobs program. Let them take some time, see if they can find a job. If they can't, then they should move into this sort of a program. And same with welfare. There could be some individuals that are not able to work. Maybe they have disabilities. Maybe they have addictions that make it impossible for them to hold a steady job. And we need to take care of them, too. So this is not meant to be a replacement for welfare. So this is really not workfare. Workfare is where we say in order to get your welfare payments, you actually have to go work for them. This is a purely voluntary program for people who want a job.
How much money do we spend on unemployment benefits now? Is it a huge chunk of change?
Oh, boy, off the top of my head, I'd have to look that up. I have in the past costed out this sort of a program that I'm talking about that would create, say, 25 million jobs at the minimum wage plus benefits, as you said earlier. And then from this program, we can deduct the cost. Let me just say, this would be somewhere around $150 billion. The typical experience with programs like this is that it's about 1% of GDP. That's a rough rule of thumb. But from that, you can deduct the savings that you get, because many people who are now collecting unemployment benefits would prefer to take a job. And you can deduct the extra health costs that come from unemployment. You can deduct the extra crime costs and so on. The net cost of the program probably comes down to pretty close to zero when you tally up the savings and subtract those from the wage costs of the program.
Thanks, Doug, very much for your call. We have time for maybe one or two more calls. Kyle in Two Rivers, hi.
Hi. I guess I would have to disagree with the guest today with his program. I understand what he's saying about job creation and programs, much like an Army Corps of Engineers or something, but what I see is everything comes down to money. Where's the money coming from? The fact of the matter is that state and local governments are broke. I'm not doubting that there's work that could be done and needs to be done, but I just don't see where the money would come in for that.
State and local governments are broke. They're in the worst fiscal crisis they've been in since the Great Depression, and it's only going to get worse. Their tax revenue is disappearing, and their local needs are increasing because they're the ones who are stuck, for the most part, taking care of poor people, taking care of crime, and also taking care of all the houses that have been foreclosed. So, yeah, state and local governments are broke. They don't have the money to run this program. That's why the funding has to come from the federal government. So I would let state and local governments create the jobs, you know, do the projects. Since I brought up foreclosures, you know, we've got lots of houses that need to be taken care of. You don't want to be living next to a foreclosed house that's getting broken windows and the lawn is growing and so on. So state and local governments need to take care of these things. The federal government, in spite of the Peterson-funded deficit hysteria going on in Washington, is not broke. It really cannot become broke. It is the issuer of our national currency. And what I'm going to say now is shocking, and I hate to do this at the end of the program because I'm not going to have time to explain it.
We can ponder it for the rest of the day, if not beyond. Go right ahead.
Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, was asked by Congress, where are you getting all of this money to buy the toxic waste from banks? Because the Fed has been buying these mortgage-backed securities that banks don't want because they're worthless. And he was asked, where do you get the money? He said, look, it's really simple. The way the government spends is with a keystroke. We credit a bank account. Okay? This is the truth. This is the way the federal government spends. It can't run out of keystrokes. It's impossible. Okay? That doesn't mean the government can't spend too much. It could cause inflation if it spends too much. It can spend in the wrong areas. It can have bad programs. It can make mistakes. The federal government is certainly not flawless, but it can't run out of money. It cannot go broke in its own currency. And how would we pay the wages for 25 million people who flowed into this program? We would credit their bank accounts. They would then go to the grocery store. They'd buy some groceries. Their checking account will be debited. The checking account of the store will be credited. the store can hire some new employees to deal with the new customers. They will order more goods to stock the shelves. That's going to create jobs at Campbell Soup Company and so on, producing the canned goods. So it will provide the aggregate demand that some of the listeners were worried about. It will create the jobs, and we can't run out of money.
Professor Ray, thank you so much for a stimulating hour. Enjoyed it. Professor Randall Ray is a professor of economics and research director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. You can read his piece on full employment in The Nation. Just go online and you can find the article. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks for all of your wonderful phone calls. We'll be with you again in a few minutes after the news.